Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is Tamina Watson, your host of Tamina Talks Immigration. Welcome. This summer, I decided to record a series called Legal Heroes in the Trump Era. I wanted to speak with some of the lawyers who have stepped up beyond their day jobs to make a difference in immigration, civil rights, and much more. I wanted their insights from their work in the last 4 years so we can learn lessons to take into the future, especially as one of the most consequential elections in America lies ahead. The interview series became a book called Legal Heroes in the Trump Era, The Inspired, Expand Your Impact, Change the World. The book can be found on Amazon and other outlets. I hope you will pick it up. Enjoy these interviews. I hope you'll learn a lot. Thank you so much for listening.
Hey, podcast listeners. Be sure to tune into Tamina Talks Immigration, where immigration attorney Tamina Watson discusses the latest on immigration news and issues. She talks to those who have impacted U.S. immigration laws and policies, as well as notable immigrants who have made great contributions. Check out Tamina Talks Immigration to also hear your questions be answered. Subscribe now for the latest on everything and anything immigration.
The Legal Heroes series of interviews were conducted during the summer of 2020. This particular interview was recorded on June 26th. Please keep that in mind as you hear any topical references. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. This is Tamina Watson on Tamina Talks Immigration. Today, I have an incredible guest, and I cannot wait for you to hear from him about all the wonderful things he's been doing as a legal hero. My guest today is Bob Ferguson. He is the Attorney General of Washington State, an absolute superhero, if you haven't heard of him already. And he is going to talk a little bit about the things that we've been talking about in this series. Welcome, Mr. Attorney General.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on. Really appreciate it. Great to see you.
Great to see you too. Well, you know, a lot of people have seen you in the newspapers and they've even seen you in these wonderful magazines with a cape on. And it would be nice for them to know a little bit about you. So where were you born and where did you grow up?
Sure. So my family, I'm a fourth generation Washingtonian. So I grew up right here in Washington State. I'm dialing in right here from North Seattle. So I grew up not too far from here. So I grew up in Seattle. And I'm one of seven kids, six boys, one long-suffering sister, and a family of seven. So it was a big kind of rambunctious family as a kid growing up. And so that had a big influence on my life, as you might imagine. But Washington State's been home for my family since back to territorial days here in Washington State.
Well, that's wonderful. Not a lot of you around here.
It's true.
And kudos to your sister for managing to make it.
she rules the roost at this point. She's in charge of the operation, as you might imagine. So I think it was hard for her growing up with all those brothers. I think now, honestly, she enjoys it, right? It's kind of being the one sister with all those brothers. I think in the end, it turned out okay for her.
Well, wonderful, wonderful. Well, I'm going to dive into lawyerly stuff. Did you always want to be a lawyer?
No. I thought point guard for the Seattle Sonics back when we used to have a pro basketball team. That was my dream as a kid growing up. Like a lot of kids, I was running around playing sports, playing ball. And actually, when I was a kid, what I really kind of thought I would do is be a professional chess player. Once I kind of got to my teenage years, I was very serious about chess, played a lot of tournament chess, and I was very serious about it. So no, the idea of being a lawyer, I'm not sure when it first entered my mind, but you know, no, I was not thinking about being a lawyer when I was in grade school, maybe even really in high school. Maybe the thought passed my mind, but not on any real concrete sense, no.
And then how did it all come about then?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that there was one moment where I had an epiphany. It wasn't like I went to see somebody speak and said, that's what I want to do. So it wasn't that. What I would say, it was gradual. But I'd say there was an experience that had a profound impact on me, and that certainly pushed me in that direction and gave me greater clarity about what kind of lawyer I might want to be. And that was after I finished college at the University of Washington, I decided to spend a year doing service, service of some kind. So I thought about the Peace Corps or VISTA. What I ended up joining was the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. I'm from a big Catholic family. Late uncle was a Jesuit. So it's essentially volunteer service in different communities around the country and really around the world. And so I did that and for a year, worked with other volunteers, and I lived and worked in a community that was economically very poor, a lot of challenges for that community, And I was helping people with an emergency services office, helping people with food, clothing, shelter, utility bills. And I also taught an after-school tutoring program. And while it was a wonderful experience, and I got a lot out of it and opened my eyes to a lot of injustices that we have in our society, I noticed that there was a legal clinic in the neighborhood, just literally a end of the block from where I lived. And while I never got to know those lawyers well or the people who worked there, I remember having the sense that what was going on there in that legal clinic was perhaps getting at the more systemic issues in that in the injustices that that community faced than maybe I could. In other words, I felt I could provide a Band-Aid to get somebody through another day. And don't get me wrong, that's a very important service to provide, right? But I was kind of, it appealed to me, this idea of, hey, lawyers maybe have additional powers. That law is a powerful tool. You can do different things. You can get to structural changes maybe in a way that you cannot as essentially a social worker. And so that was maybe when I really first thought, yeah, you know, law school and maybe the kind of law that helps people. And so I actually applied to law schools while I was living in that community at that time.
Oh, wow. And I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would love for people to know how you got to where you are today, but you've got a very long, accomplished career. Are you able to give us a summary?
Sure. You know, folks often say, well, Bob, you know, how'd you become Attorney General? How'd that happen? And I guess just at a high level, a couple of thoughts. Number one, you know, I didn't grow up with some plan to be the Attorney General of the state of Washington. You know, that just wasn't on my radar. It was not on my radar as a law student. It wasn't on my radar as a law clerk. That was not on my mind at all. So like a lot of things in life, things kind of gradually went that way. What I would say is that, and this is advice I often give is to law students, for example, is they often ask, what courses should I take? You know, and I often say, look, sir, follow your passion. I mean, truly, you know, do the work that interests you. First, I think we do our best work doing what we love to do. And that's, for the most part, what I've done with my life, even just being a professional chess player I actually went and became a professional chess player. And you wouldn't think that would have any relevance to being an attorney general, but actually my training as a chess master helps me in profound ways in the work that I do. And so I really encourage people, don't feel like there's some linear track you have to follow. And for me, that's just how it worked out. What I would say is that probably back when I did that volunteer service, I knew at that moment, whatever I was going to do with my life, and if I went to law school as a lawyer, it had to be public service focused. That's what it had to be. I want to be helping people. I just don't have an interest in making money. I have zero relationship to money, for better or for worse. I'm just really interested in helping people out and using law to do that. So whether that was going to be as a public defender or in politics, I wasn't clear, but things eventually just worked out. And I do remember at some point when I was serving on the King County Council, I remember thinking, hey, if I was running for a higher office, what would that be? And in thinking about it, it became clear, Attorney General. I said, now that's a job that appeals to me. It combines the law, the power of the law. You're an executive. You run a large law firm, policy and politics all into one place. And that really appealed to me. So I would say when I was on the King County Council, I actually started thinking about that job and then researching it. And at some point I thought, okay, if I ever run for another office, that's where I would go.
Oh, wow. When you were practicing law, what kind of law were you practicing?
Yeah, so after I finished law school, I spent 2 years as a law clerk for two federal judges, a trial court judge in Spokane, then a judge on the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, an experience I encourage for law students who can clerk and have the honor of clerking. I really encourage it. It was a great way to see how the court works through the eyes of a judge, which is very valuable, I think, to a future lawyer. And then I went to work in private practice at Preston Gates & Ellis, now K&L Gates. I was there for about 4 to 5 years. I did litigation work. So a lot of the work that the firm did at that time that I was involved in was work on behalf of public entities, counties, cities, port districts. And a lot of that work, for example, was being part of the legal team that challenged Tim Iman initiatives in courts. So that was a big part of my work. But of course, I represent all sorts of private entities and other organizations as well that were firm clients at that time.
How interesting, because of course, that litigation experience is, you know, coupled with your chess experience is really obviously making you one of the most effective attorney generals that we have in the country. So I'm so glad. You know, I want to talk a little bit about November 2016 before we talk about the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. We all remember that night when we lost the election. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that night and what was going through your mind?
Oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah, I'll never forget it. You know, honestly, it's a little hard to talk about. I mean, in part because, you know, my wife and I have two kids. They're now 12. So on an election 4 years ago, they would have been 8, I think it was. And one of those twins is a daughter, Katie. And she was very interested in the fact that a a girl, as she would say, a woman had never been president of the United States. And so she became a Hillary Clinton supporter. You know, she had her buttons, she had a t-shirt. She was on board. And, you know, I remember her asking me if she was going to win. And I remember telling Katie, yeah, Hillary's going to win. And I was very confident right at the end that Hillary's going to win. Of course, on election night, things unraveled. And, you know, the hardest part of that night for me, just personally, setting aside Donald Trump now being the president, but on the personal side, you know, trying to explain to Katie how that had happened and what that meant. And that was hard, you know, I'm just speaking as a father, right? As a father, that was, you know, that was hard. And so I'll never forget that night. I did have an awareness outside being a father now, putting my attorney general hat on. I remember when I gave my speech that night before a huge room full of Democrats, there was a big election night party and everybody, of course, was in a state of shock. And I do remember saying at that time, look, if the unthinkable happens and Donald Trump actually does win, that point it looked likely. I said the most important political job in the country at that point will be the job of attorney general. And I said, at that point, I sort of promised that I would make sure that Donald Trump, if he was president, that I would make sure he followed the laws, that we'd hold him accountable to the rule of law. Look, I had no idea back then just you know, how true that would have to become. I had no inkling of it, but that was my message to supporters that night.
Very profound speech, I'd say. If there was a way to actually watch that, I'd love to. Between November and January, did you take any steps towards what, you know, you had to do eventually?
Oh my gosh, yeah. So yes, I guess the short version of that would be that essentially immediately after the election, yes, I reached out to my team and said, hey, you know, we may be taking on an additional role here for the next 4 years of making sure that some of these outrageous things that the president was saying, calling for all sorts of discriminatory actions against Muslim Americans, for example, right? A total and complete shutdown of Muslims coming to the United States was a campaign pledge of his. So what I said to the team was, look, let's identify what he said during his campaign, that if he actually executed on that as president, we would want to consider a legal challenge. So to be clear, I think it's fair to say that I underestimated Donald Trump as a candidate for president. I did not think on election day he was going to win. So I just told myself, look, I'm not going to make the same mistake twice. I'm not going to underestimate him again. If he said during the campaign that he would do something as president, I'm going to take him at face value. As you might recall, a lot of people said, well, he's campaigning that way. He won't really do those things. We were under no illusion about that. And so I remember talking to my team, we had a lot of conversations and I asked them to get ready. And what we did was we identified certain areas because of course the universe is vast of what he could do that'd be problematic, but we only have so many resources. And I did say we focus on issues, immigration, civil rights, and the environment were three areas that I told the team do a particular focus on those things that he pledged to do during the campaign. And so that included a travel ban. Like we were thinking about that during the months you mentioned before he actually took office.
What profound insight, because I think those few weeks that we had were absolutely crucial in getting into position. Because had we not been in position, you and others who have are part of this series, actually, had we not been in those spots, we would not have been able to act as quickly as we did. Now,
I think that's true. I mean, one thing I will add is, you know, I sort of talked about my life as a chess professional and sort of mentioned how it influences my life as an attorney general. Just to give you one example, you know, in chess, if we're playing a game of chess, my job is to anticipate what your next move is going to be. That's all I'm focused on. And if you make a move that I did not anticipate or did not see, that's a problem. That's a problem. And so I think we utilized that time well before he took office, after he was elected, to anticipate what his moves would be as president. And that we were just focused on that. What would he do? Would he try this? Would he try that? Would he try this? Now, of course, we couldn't imagine what exactly a travel ban might look like, but we knew that was a possibility. And so the team could start that process. The other thing we could do was prioritize, you know? And so I communicated to the team, look, if, for example, a travel ban is executed, we're going to work that day on it. We're not, you know, if it's on a Friday, we're not waiting until Monday to roll into the office. That's top priority. We have resources. We know who's going to work on that case. We're on it. And that paid huge dividends, of course, once the travel ban was executed.
Absolutely. And, you know, just a side note, while you were doing that, I went to our Immigration Lawyers Association. I said, you've got to give me a committee. And during that time, I built up the committee. And because I had just come off Hillary Clinton's immigration working group, and I had seen what she was going to do, I took a little bit of those lessons and put them in place. But you're right, we couldn't necessarily predict. You just had to be in position with that mindset. And of course, the dreaded day had arrived. It was January 27th, Friday at 5 p.m. And, you know, we're going to run out of time before we get to it, but I want to ask you to give a summary of what happened. And I want people to realize that you took one of the bravest steps that day because you did ask other attorney generals to join you and nobody was brave enough. So give us a little snapshot of that, those moments.
Yeah. So it was executed on a Friday night, as you said, and, you know, my team knew to go into action. So Saturday morning, some folks were traveling. One woman on my team, Marsha Chen, was on a ski trip. It was on vacation. So everybody just got back to town, right? And Saturday morning, everybody was in the office and went to work on a potential legal challenge. And I guess, long story short, I remember meeting with the team at some point that day. And, you know, we felt we had some good legal arguments. As you might recall, legal experts like Jeffrey Toobin on Anderson Cooper's show, legal experts are saying a legal challenge will never work. The president has too much power to make this executive order. It's not going to work. But we felt we had good arguments. And so I remember talking with the team and saying, hey, do we think we could file this on Monday? Which was a completely unreasonable request, of course, of the team to put together this huge complex case with declarations in a weekend. But the team thought they might be able to pull it off. And I felt it was important because, you know, I wanted to communicate to the people of my state that I thought the policy was outrageous. I thought it was unlawful. And I did not want one business day to go by where the people of the state might wonder, was anyone going to challenge this thing? And so to the team's enormous credit, and I'm obviously short-circuiting an extremely intense weekend, as you might imagine, and a couple of weeks on that case, they pulled it off and we got that thing filed. And that was rewarding for a lot of reasons. But I think it also did, to your point, I think it helped inspire other attorneys general. Once we filed that, they joined on to that case eventually. And the winning of that case, that first travel ban, had enormous consequences for the future of all the subsequent litigation that AGs have brought together against the administration, because there was not a huge clamoring that weekend for folks to join on the lawsuit. Let's just put it that way.
Absolutely. And I want to take a moment to acknowledge your leadership. Because not only did you have the foresight, yes, you had an incredible team, you got the best A-plus team, but without leadership and foresight and direction, that wouldn't have happened. And your leadership really was a crucial part of everything that has followed, and we will talk a little bit about that. So I'm so glad. And you will know, if you didn't know already, Washingtonians and Americans in general were very, very grateful for the steps that you had taken then. But since then, of course, there's been lawsuit after lawsuit. And we're going to run out of time if we go through all of them. Are you able to give us some inkling of some of the bigger ones that you've handled that are fighting against this administration? It doesn't have to be just immigration, because every aspect of our lives are under assault.
Yeah. So what I would say is we have now, Washington State, as of today, as we're taping this, we have filed 64 lawsuits against the administration. Many of those we've joined with other states, some we file on our own. And we have 30 decisions in those cases. We've won 29 out of 30. So our track record's pretty good. What I would say is that half of those cases are actually about one general topic, and that's the environment, that this administration is just systematically rolling back environmental protection. So we work closely with California and other states on those lawsuits. It's always hard to pick out one or two of those 64 that are most important, of course, because as you can appreciate, they're all important for different reasons. But I would have to say that the case we just prevailed on in support of Dreamers and the DACA program was huge. I mean, the consequences for the 800,000 Dreamers across the country, have we lost that case, was, just to be blunt, deportation to a country they don't know. And the 18,000 Washingtonians who are Dreamers, who I, you know, meet with many of them and talk to many of them. So I think we all felt the pressure of that case, and the stakes were high. We were at the U.S. Supreme Court, of course, with other states. We co-led that case with New York and Massachusetts. So we knew the stakes were very, very high. And to have pulled that off, team effort, Dreamers spoke out, organizations, states got together. But I would say, given what was at stake, literally whether those 800,000 people could continue to live in the only country they've ever known, was significant. And that was rewarding. And to persuade Justice Roberts that our case was on the right side, it felt good.
That was an amazing decision. I don't know if many of us slept for days thinking it's going to come out today or it's going to come out on Thursday. And to see the shockingly pleasant, you know, result was heartwarming for everybody. And in fact, to that point, you know, through Wyden, we had prepared lawyers in Washington State through a CLE program to make sure that they were on standby because we didn't know. If anything, the wider thought was it would go the other way. So incredible thanks from me, from the Lawyers Association, from everybody, because we know what you have done. And I'm so glad that you brought that up. Talking about environment and maybe one other area, are there any other things that you could maybe just pull out, just one other area of law where you have won a case against the administration?
Sure. So another area that's been a particular focus, I think it's fair to say, for my office with the administration is related to Betsy DeVos, Secretary of Education, who has been a challenge. And so we have had a fair amount of litigation against the Department of Education, Betsy DeVos, that part of the administration. So just as one quick example, we just prevailed on a case just, I think, a week or so ago here in Washington State, in the Eastern District of Washington. Complex case, but in a nutshell, what it was when Congress enacted the CARES Act to help people all across the country grappling with the economic impacts of COVID-19, part of that CARES Act included financial assistance for college students across the country. Very important for those college students who are struggling. Betsy DeVos then followed up on Congress acting in that way, and she placed all these arbitrary restrictions on which college students could get those dollars. So for example, Dreamers, if you're a college student, could not access those dollars. If your grade point average wasn't sufficiently high, you could not access those dollars. We felt that was outrageous. We also thought it was illegal. And so we challenged that here in Washington State, and we won. We just got an injunction on that. So, you know, that's a case that may not be on the front pages of the New York Times, but for the thousands of Washington students who suddenly now can access that financial aid, that's a lifeline for them, as you might imagine, during this time. So an important case, but that area on issues for consumers and students and Betsy DeVos has been a big focus as well.
I'm so glad you brought up education because I don't think that is understood as much. And I think the dismantling of the education system that this education secretary is doing is absolutely, I don't even have a word for it. It's illegal in my opinion because you're really ruining the future of this country. And she's really dismantling it one by one, where it's done in such a manner that you're not even noticing the huge impact. So I'm so glad that you are actually on top of it because I really wanted to bring a legal hero on the education system and I haven't quite got there. So you touched it. So I really appreciate it. So we are going to run out of time. I want to ask you a few other questions about lawyering in the Trump era. You know, a lot of us have gone to school with a notion that we're going to change the world, but then life kicks in. You know, there are bills to pay and deadlines to meet and you're normally at your desk. But fighting the administration has changed for a lot of us and we're doing it in different ways. What would you say lawyering has become in the Trump era?
Well, I guess it's a thoughtful question. I think what I would say is that lawyers have a special responsibility, I think, in a time of a national crisis, which I think we're in the middle of, to be candid. And that's always been true in our nation's history, where you often see lawyers step up in times of crisis to ensure that the rule of law is being followed. And frankly, to bring out the best of us as a nation, right? To make sure, hey, the words of our Constitution are upheld in the courts. Thurgood Marshall, the civil rights movement, right? I mean, we think of him at the Supreme Court, but Thurgood Marshall was, as a lawyer, traveling with a whole army of attorneys and professional staff through the Deep South at a challenging time in our nation's history, advocating on behalf of African-American defendants in cases all across the South, and doing that work to trying to uphold the rule of law and bring about change. So I guess what I would say is as lawyers is we have that special responsibility. It's certainly one that I take seriously. And I think what I would say to any lawyer or someone who's thinking about being a lawyer is, you know, at some point in one's career to spend time engaged in some form of public interest law, whatever that is. We can always carve out that time or at some point in your career, step away from a private practice. And I don't begrudge anyone who does private practice, did it myself. But I do think we owe it to our community because the need is so great. The need is so great for folks to have an attorney who knows what they're doing. And, you know, a quorum is a great level playing field, but only if you have an advocate in that courtroom on your behalf. Without that advocate, it's not. That's just the way it is. And so all of us as lawyers have that responsibility, I think, to give back in some way at some point in their career. For me, I'm very lucky to have the job that I have at the time I have it. I thank God every day that I do. But all of us have a role to play.
You know, I agree 100% because however much time you have in your day, you can actually do something. Mm-hmm. You don't have to take on a huge case, but you can do something. Mm-hmm. Now, one of my last questions is activism. Part of what we have been doing, in my opinion, is legal activism. Would you agree?
I mean, I suppose. I'm not sure. You know, I guess it depends how you define activism. I guess what I would say is, I guess just the way I think about it is I'm just doing my job. I mean, that may sound oversimplistic, but it's true. You know, people often say to me, well, you know, Bob, why are you filing all these lawsuits against the Trump administration? My answer is, well, if I think someone, anyone is violating the law and it's harming Washingtonians and we have good legal arguments, why would I not file that lawsuit? That's my job, right? Whether that's a company not playing by the rules or the president not playing by the rules. And so I can see how it's viewed as activism, don't get me wrong, but I guess in terms of how, when I'm sitting around the table with my legal team thinking about a case against the president, those aren't the words we're using. We're talking about the law. We're talking about the Administrative Procedure Act. We're talking about the Constitution, right? Talking about the facts of our case and trying to reach a conclusion, because the conclusion can't be I'm filing a lawsuit because I can't stand what Betsy DeVos is doing, or I'm outraged by Donald Trump's latest action. It has to be they have violated the law and we think we can win this case. That's all it's really about. And so we don't take a poll saying, do you oppose what he's doing or support what he's doing? No, I'm not interested in that. It's, hey, do we think this is harming Washingtonians? And do we think this is a good case and we can win? And so, you know, whether that's activism or not, I don't know. What I can say is for me, I really do simply view that's my job and that's doing my job. And frankly, if I fail to file a lawsuit like that first Muslim travel ban, well, then I'm not doing my job at the most basic level.
A very interesting perspective. And I think it's very profound to say we're just doing our job. And I think that's the thing that I want people to take away from this, that as a lawyer, you have an obligation to society, whether you accept it or not, and to look around you and see that democracy and the rule of law is really in danger. And all of us, if we come together, we can protect it. Well, Mr. Attorney General, I'm so grateful that you are part of this show and this part of this series of legal heroes, because there's no bigger hero in my book than you. And I'm so grateful. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for the kind words. Great to see you. And thanks again. Hope you have a great day.
You too.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Tamina Talks is brought to you by Watson Immigration Law. Founded in 2009, Watson Immigration Law is one of Seattle's premier immigration firms, specializing in business and investment visas, but offering a wide range of immigration services. If you need assistance with your immigration needs, Watson Immigration Law is ready to help. Just call 206-292-5237 to schedule an appointment. Mention this podcast to receive a 10% discount off your initial consultation fee. Today's episode was produced and edited by Nicole Lockett.